This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at reports of random shootings along I-96, covering four counties. How concerned should we truly be?
Millions of people take out their trash every day, and how many of them are shot at? I mean, it's an incredibly rare event.
Plus, we check on Michigan's film industry, struggling after tax breaks were cut way back.
Detroit and Michigan is just a plethora of these wonderful locations, and Hollywood fell in love, and they came running, and that's why we had so many movies here.
Plus, the business of lobbying in Lansing.
Our state is known nationally almost as the Wild Wild West when it comes to both campaign finance disclosure and lobbying requirements.
Those stories and more coming up on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is a significant day for those of us who put Stateside together, and for you who are tuning in to listen to us on this wonderful, unseasonably warm fall Michigan day. Thanks to your support, we are boosting Stateside from a once-a-week show to 4 days a week. We'll be there for you Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays from 3 to 4, and then rebroadcast every night at 10. As we work hard to make Stateside the kind of show we know that you want, we want to hear from you. What issues matter to you? What stories and people have grabbed your attention? Find us and let us know online at michiganradio.org, on Facebook under Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y, or on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, we thank you for joining us on Stateside right here on Michigan Radio. On today's show, Jocelyn Benson joins us. She's an election law professor and a former candidate for Secretary of State. We're going to talk about her efforts to clean up lobbying here in Michigan. We'll get an update on Governor Snyder's town hall meeting in Detroit, where he's pushing for that new international bridge to Windsor. And we begin our first of two conversations about the state of the film industry here in Michigan. But first, to our top story. A large police task force is hard at work today, searching for the person behind a series of shootings that began last week, centered along the I-96 corridor. To date, 22 people have reported being shot at, all of them motorists except for one man who was taking out his trash. Luckily, no one has been hurt, but police say there have been some very close calls. Reports have come from Oakland, Livingston, Ingham, and Shiawassee counties. That large police task force includes Wixom Police, sheriffs from the four counties, the Michigan State Police, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, all coordinating the search for the shooter. A police sketch was released over the weekend based on witness descriptions, and police have stepped up patrols of I-96. All of this brings to mind random shootings in 2002 around Washington, D.C., shootings that ultimately left 10 people dead and 3 critically wounded. And in 2003, there were 24 sniper attacks in Ohio, especially concentrated around I-270 in Columbus. One person was killed then. There is something especially unsettling about a random crime like this, thinking that you or a loved one could become a target for doing nothing beyond driving on I-96. But how worried should we be? And how likely really are we to become a victim of a random crime like this? Professor Brad Bushman is with Ohio State University. He's a professor of communication and psychology, and he joins us now from Columbus. Professor, what is it that makes us fear the unlikely, such as a random shooting on a freeway, even more than we fear the likely, for example, car crashes?
Yeah, when people judge the likelihood or the frequency of an event, they search their memories for instances of that event occurring. And the more easily those instances come to mind, the more frequent they think they are. And the problem with events like this is they're very salient, they're very noticeable, and they come to mind very frequently. And so even though they're quite rare, people, when they think about such events, they can readily recall instances of those events. And so they think that they're more common, much more common than they actually are. And scientists call that the availability heuristic.
And is that here as in here and now, or what does that word mean?
H-E-U-R-I-S-T-I-C.
Okay.
A heuristic is just a mental device that people use to make quick decisions.
Okay, and we use that every day. Well, with that in mind, if it is way more likely that I could die in a car crash, let's say, compared to a random shot being fired by someone, how is it I can feel so comfortable driving? What's going on to kind of let me just get in that car and not think twice?
Yeah, because the same heuristic. You can readily recall instances in your life when you've driven safely to different locations, and you can't remember so many incidents when you had terrible crashes. So you assume that because you can't remember any horrific incidents that they must not be so common.
So the headlines that we're hearing that someone hears a bullet ping by as he takes the trash out, or someone is, you know, chugging along a freeway and cuts home and realizes that that sound they heard turned out to be a bullet hole. The rarity of that makes it bigger in our heads?
Exactly. Millions of people take out their trash every day, and how many of them are shot at? I mean, it's an incredibly rare event, but the news features such events, and a common phrase in the news is, if it bleeds, it leads, and the news often focuses on the most horrific, violent scenes, and those are the ones that come most readily to mind.
I guess I'd ask you this then, Professor Bushman. How do you feel a story such as this one that we're going through here in Michigan with a series of shootings? You certainly went through it in 2003 in Ohio. How should those stories be covered? How do you balance the need to inform and to make people aware with tipping over the edge and getting breathless and sensational?
Exactly the way you're doing it. I think it's really wonderful that you're talking about the actual frequency of such events and how rare they actually are, and that people should, of course, be aware that such incidents happen, but that they're extremely rare, that millions of people take out the trash or drive safely without people taking pot shots at them, and that the likelihood that something will happen to them is very small.
And how do you think that we as media consumers and also as parents should approach a story like this one?
I think we should help our children remember instances when they've taken out the trash safely, or when they've driven with us safely, and when things have not happened, rather than focusing on the horrific things that might happen but probably won't happen.
I guess the other issue that here, it feels so very powerless. I think often when something happens bad, some bad thing happens to someone, if there's a context, oh, they were at a drug den, or oh, they were walking at 2 a.m. in an alley where they shouldn't have been, that's something we do in our own minds, isn't it, to make us feel just a little more distant?
It is, and that's what's perhaps most troubling about these shootings, is their random nature. Because people like to have control of their lives. They like to have predictable lives. They like to understand what will happen in the future. And when we lose that sense of control, it's very unnerving.
Let me have you go a little deeper, if I could, Dr. Bushman, into what you would like to see the media do, particularly the television news. They're driven by having something for the 6 a.m., the 7 a.m., the noon, the 5, the 6, the 11. What would you like to see happen in the way they might cover the news like this?
Well, I think it's responsible journalism to cover such events, but also to talk about how infrequent those events are. I guess I would, for example, get some statistics on the number of people who took out their trash during that 2-day period, and comfort viewers by telling them that, you know, it's an incredibly rare event that only one person who took out their trash was shot at, but many, many more were not shot at. And I would talk about all the people who traveled to and from work safely on the freeways who were not shot at. Those are busy roads. I've been on them many times myself, and it's just an extremely rare event for somebody to be shot at on a freeway. So although the events are random and we feel out of control, we should feel comforted knowing that they're very rare.
When we think about the fact that I know all weekend, I was at the U of M MSU tailgate party and people were talking about this, it becomes, for lack of something better, water cooler buzz. What are we doing there? Is that part of our innate need to share stories and to say, oh, my word, thank God that wasn't me? What's happening?
Yeah, well, people do like to share information, especially information that others may not be aware of. But, you know, it also can have a potentially destructive effect because what people are doing is rehearsing these horrific events. And when people rehearse these events, they more easily come to mind. And the availability heuristic proposes, the more easily something comes to mind, the more frequent and likely we think it is. And so I think it just makes these events more available to us. We assume they're more frequent than they actually are, and that that type of buzz actually just makes it worse rather than better.
And I am guessing, am I right, that this is really something part of being human? So in essence, if there was an awful mastodon attack in the prehistoric era that killed a hunter, they'd all be talking about it around the tribal fire, right?
Probably.
Appreciate your help, Dr.
Sure.
Bushman. Dr. Brad Bushman with Ohio State University, professor of communication and psychology. Thanks for talking with us today
Sure.
on Stateside. On to a lighter note now, with a big congrats to everyone who took part in yesterday's Detroit Marathon. Unofficial results show the race was won by a time of 2 hours, 25 minutes, and 26 seconds for the men, 2 hours, 46 minutes, 33 seconds for the women. The marathon and half marathon took runners across the Ambassador Bridge into Windsor and through the Windsor Tunnel back into Detroit. Runners came from all 50 states and 16 countries. The Detroit Free Press notes that yesterday's oldest runner was Bob Ranta of South Lyon, 80 years old. Bob finished the race in 6 hours, 27 minutes, and 12 seconds. Congrats. Still to come, lobbying in Michigan. Are we really like, as one election law professor puts it, the wild, wild west? And Governor Rick Snyder fighting back against Proposal 6, the ongoing duel between the governor and the billionaire. Those stories and more ahead on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With just 15 days left before Election Day, tons of focus is turned to candidates and the politicians who are trying to stay in office or win office, to the latest polls and campaign gaffes. During this campaign frenzy, little attention is being paid to a group that plays a pretty big part in everyday politics, lobbyists and special interest groups. It seems just about every leader who takes office, including President Barack Obama and Governor Rick Snyder, comes in promising to clamp down, to peel back the layers that surround dealings between lobbyists, special interest groups, and our elected officials. The results of those promises tend to be, to put it kindly, underwhelming. We got to wondering, how are we doing here in Michigan in terms of the business of lobbying and courting lawmakers in Lansing? Are these dealings as transparent as you, the voter, deserves? Jocelyn Benson is an election law professor at Wayne State University. She founded and directs the Michigan Center for Election Law and Administration, and she's a former Democratic candidate for Secretary of State. Jocelyn, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Center for Public Integrity, I saw that gave Michigan a grade of F on its corruption risk report card, which might lead one to conclude our state's a little lacking in areas of ethics and transparency. Your thoughts on that F grade?
Yes, unfortunately, I was not surprised. Our state is known nationally almost as the Wild Wild West when it comes to both campaign finance disclosure and lobbying requirements, as well as we're one of the only three states in the country that do not require our elected officials to disclose their personal finances, which is critical to ensure that those we elect to office are not being influenced by their own personal financial interests.
And I saw that after that F grade, the House Democrats jumped in and proposed a package of reform bills. How's that working out for
him? Yes, I was part of that package and helped propose some of the reforms. But unfortunately, we've seen a lot of talk and not a lot of action from the leadership in the House and in the Senate. But, you know, that I think teaches us and history guides us on this as well. Real reform is only going to come when citizens on the ground demand it because the system is not set up to reform itself. There's no interest in, for example, in the lobbying corps in Lansing in promoting more disclosure. But there is interest from the citizens. And so really the only thing that's going to change things is if citizens amplify their voices in pushing for these reforms.
And do you hear that from citizens? Or is it one of those things where I'm worried about making my mortgage payment or I'm worried about whether I can find a job? Whatever when it comes to lobbyists.
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of things that are pressing all of us these days mm-hmm. in these high unemployment times and all the rest. But at the root of every single issue that we are concerned with as citizens is this question of who's influencing our legislators mm-hmm. and who's influencing our lawmakers. And so having access to that information and regulating that influence is critical to ensuring everything else that we care about moves forward the way that we want it as opposed to the way special interests want it.
Now, lobbying is certainly the influence industry on all levels of our government. And a lobbyist may say his or her role is an educator in teaching lawmakers about the client's view or knowledge of issues. And a lawmaker may say, well, if I meet with a lobbyist, it helps me gather all the information I need to make the right decision. Is that at all a fair argument in your view?
Well, what's critical to our democracy is that our citizenry is informed. And what happens is these meetings that you're talking about, they go on behind closed doors, and citizens who are really in charge in a democracy aren't able to hold our elected officials accountable if we don't even know about who they're meeting with and who's quote-unquote educating them. Now, that aside, apart from that, yes, we certainly want to ensure our lawmakers are informed as well. Mm-hmm. But we want to know that they're being informed and not bribed, at the worst sense, or pushed to vote a certain way in support of financial interests that may be supporting their campaign. And that's why disclosure is so important, because it not only enables us as citizens to know who our lawmakers are meeting with, but it also puts a check on the lawmakers themselves to know, well, I don't want to do this that may be seen as unethical because it's going to be exposed. People will know about it. And I think that will hold back some of the potential unethical behavior that we may see otherwise.
What kind of unethical? Give us some four instances of unethical behavior that has really struck you as egregious, and we really need to fix this.
Well, I think you know the story of the bridge, the new international trade crossing over the past several years, and Mattie Maroon's influence over legislators and not bringing the bridge up to a vote and those sorts of mm-hmm. things is one of the most egregious things that we've seen, and it's a continuing saga that seems to go year to year, regardless of which party's in office and who's in charge. But that said, we've also seen things like out in West Michigan, we've seen lawmakers switch sides, switch parties, and try to recruit shill candidates to run against them to ensure their reelection. Up in northern Michigan, we've seen a large company try to influence local lawmakers who were on the fence as to whether to allow them to build a store in their town up in Ames Township. Mm-hmm. The company essentially ran ads against those who were opposing their store being built in the town, and it made it much more difficult for those lawmakers to stay in office at the local level. So we've seen it at the elected level with big businesses trying to unseat people who don't vote their way. And we've seen it at the legislative level as well, where people are pushed to vote a certain way with a threat of a recall or some other type of pressure if they don't go the way of the wealthy financial interests.
It does strike a civilian, somebody watching from the outside and looking at what's going on in the halls of Lansing and also locally, how any lawmaker who wants to chart a course and keep focused is able to do so with recall threats and the pressures, and as you say, kind of all under the surface, so it's not transparent.
Exactly.
How you even get your job done.
Yeah, and it's incredibly discouraging for citizens. I think it's one of the reasons we're seeing a decrease in turnout among citizens every election because we feel less connected to our government. And on the other side, you have very good lawmakers who may go in leading ethics reform or mm-hmm. pushing for more disclosure. But until we actually have that disclosure in place, it doesn't give us the ability to know essentially who's playing the game well in an ethical way and who's not. And that's why, again, disclosure is so important, not just to know the bad things that may be happening so that we
can hold those elected officials accountable, but to also know the good things that people are doing behind the scenes that's not disclosed, and that can help restore some of our faith, perhaps, in our elected leaders.
When you say disclosure needs to be allowed, how would you like to see, if you ran the zoo, mm-hmm. how would you like to see this disclosure done and affected?
I think we need three things. First and foremost, every time a lobbyist meets with a legislator or pays for a legislator to do something like go out to lunch or any type of money involving in a conversation with the legislature, that needs to be disclosed immediately. And it should be disclosed on the legislator's website as well as with the Secretary mm-hmm. of State. So more disclosure for lobbying transactions and money spent on lobbying in Michigan is reform number one. Number two, we have to recognize that campaigns and political season also leads to a lot of undisclosed money being spent, not just to influence our elected officials, but to influence the voters as well. So instant disclosure of all money that is going to pay for ads, robocalls, radio communications, mm-hmm. everything also needs to happen, and we don't have that in Michigan. And then third and finally, this personal financial disclosure for legislators. I mean, there's a reason why nearly every other state in the country and our federal government requires that, because if someone has a personal financial interest in what they're voting on, we need to know about it. So those three things, I think, are what we need in Michigan to bring us closer for a more transparent, ethical government.
Which I take it are in that package of reform bills that you helped work on.
They are, and I'm also the head of a coalition called the Michigan Transparency Coalition, seeking other ways, if we can't get change through the legislature, maybe seeking to push for change through a ballot initiative. We've seen many efforts to amend our Constitution this year to do various things. Mm-hmm. Well, I think our Constitution should stand for ethics and transparency, and so we're building a coalition of small business leaders and others who are interested in ensuring that Michigan is a leader, getting A's in our report cards on integrity and public service as opposed to getting an F.
I want to talk a little with you about retired lawmakers becoming lobbyists. I saw a recent Public Citizen report finding there were at least 150 former members of Congress actively lobbying their former colleagues in 2009. Do you have any sense how much that's happening in Lansing?
Yes, we've certainly seen that a lot, this revolving door mm-hmm. of people being term limited out of office mm-hmm. but staying in Lansing as a lobbyist to influence their former colleagues on behalf of a corporation or some other special interest. It's a very significant problem, and it's one that goes, frankly, under the radar a lot because it seems almost sort of technical and all the rest. But yes, we certainly need a law in Michigan to ban this revolving door. That leads to legislators returning as lobbyists the next year. Also, frankly, term limits have exacerbated this problem as well mm-hmm. because it has made that door move more quickly. And you have some very effective lawmakers being pushed out of office and seeking to work and being recruited by lobbying firms for the sole reason that they're good at influencing those who are still in elected office.
And you could kind of see from the former lawmaker's point of view, well, I'm still a player. I still have a reason to walk into the Capitol. I'm still around my former colleagues. So one could see, and I'm being paid probably a lot of money. So I suppose that you can see why that would be attractive.
And the question is, well, what's the problem with that? And to me, the problem is that it's unfair to mm-hmm. voters and to organizations or to any interest that doesn't have access to that same level of expertise. It doesn't have access to the same amount of money that can be used to hire a former lawmaker to advocate on their behalf. And that's really, to me, at the end of the day, the biggest problem with all of this. We want our government to be making decisions in light of what's best for the people and everyone in this state. And when we have these types of unfair, unethical, unaccountable mechanisms going on behind the scenes, it ultimately means our government's going to be making more decisions in favor of special interest and less decisions in favor of the people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty, talking today with Jocelyn Benson, who's a Wayne State University election law professor, and she's the founder and director of the Michigan Center for Election Law and Administration, talking about the need for more transparency in the state of Michigan with dealings between our lawmakers and the folks who are trying to influence them. Jocelyn, increasingly it strikes me that lobbyists are not just influencing legislation. They're helping to write it. Your thoughts.
That's right.
On that.
Yes. Oh, and again, one of the effects of having term limits and this sort of rapid revolving of legislators in Lansing is that the historical knowledge and the depth of knowledge often comes from those lobbyists who are helping to, quote unquote, educate the new lawmakers. And oftentimes it leads to lawmakers writing the bills or lobbyists mm-hmm. writing the bills and others as opposed to the lawmakers and their staff themselves. And that, of course, runs counter to what we want to believe our government is like. We want to believe those who we send to represent us are the ones who are crafting legislation.
But can the reality be that people are voting for bills they haven't read, much less let alone written?
Well, I think that's the case both at the state and mm-hmm. federal level, unfortunately. And certainly there's a lot of different reasons why that is, including the way in which bills can move very quickly and can be very detailed. But it's certainly disconcerting to think of the fact that our legislators quite frequently at the state and the federal level, maybe proposing legislation that they have not written, maybe supporting or voting for or against legislation that they've only seen talking points or bullets about. And again, it speaks to the need to have a more active legislator. And frankly, one of the reasons why we don't see that more is because a lot of our legislators have to raise money to run for reelection. Members of Congress and in the State House here in Lansing run every 2 years. Mm. And so an unfortunate aspect of our campaign finance system is that the bulk of legislators and candidates' time, instead of governing, is spent raising money. And as a result, they don't have time to read the bills they may be proposing or voting on.
You know, lobbying certainly is nothing new, that idea of I'll help you and you help me. I mean, Roman senators had their clients, and it was 1876 when lobbyists to Congress first had to register with the clerk. So obviously, even in 1876, people were looking going, I don't know about this. So I guess overall, would you accept that lobbying is part of the democratic process, albeit a not so elegant and rather messy process?
I think in many ways our democracy is not as great as it could be, but I believe it can be better because I believe that the more voices that are in the process, the more conversation, the more dialogue, the more citizens who are involved as lobbyists themselves, the better. And so in that regard, I think it's important to have citizens actively engaged in the process to ensure that they're countering anything that's said to our legislators by special interests, by wealthy interest. That's really what's critical. I'm certainly not opposed to any corporation, union, individual talking to legislators about their views. I mean, they have complete right to do that, and it's important that our legislators hear those views. What's absent is the views of our citizens. Oftentimes, those voices are not loud enough. And if we're going to have a government of, by, and for the people, we need to ensure that the people have the same amount of time, the same amount of opportunity to influence our legislators as those who have a lot of money have. And we don't have that right now. So I support reforms that essentially help citizens become more engaged, active, and informed, and therefore enable to be their own lobbyist so as to counter the lobbyists that are already doing quite well in Lansing.
So a citizen in your hopes would be able to get more than a form letter or a form email, template email when they reach out to a lawmaker.
Yes, and our lawmakers in exchange would be able to spend more time listening to the voices of the citizens as opposed to going out to lunch every day with lobbyists. It's a balance that we need mm-hmm. that's lacking. Mm-hmm. And though throughout time and throughout democracy, yes, there will always be those more wealthy voices, more influential voices, what we need in a democracy is balance and the sort of protection of that one person, one vote principle in every aspect of our government.
So what's the takeaway, in your view, from our discussion for citizens who are listening, who would like to see this change and would like to have more influence? What could an average citizen out there listening do to try to correct this and to push for more transparency?
Well, a number of things. One, of course, correspond with your representative and elected official and find out what they're doing to promote ethical reform and transparency reforms in our government. There are several legislators who have been pushing a lot of these reforms that we've talked about, and it's important that we support them. Now, on the other side of things, though, I do believe that real change will only come through the ballot initiative process. And so mm-hmm. I would encourage citizens to get involved with our coalition. It's the Michigan Transparency Coalition.
Coalition, and we're trying to build support for a constitutional amendment to our Michigan Constitution that would achieve these types of reforms. And the only way we could do that is with help of citizens throughout the state.
And the website for that is?
It's righttoknowmichigan.org, and you can also find us on Facebook. It's just Michigan Transparency Coalition, and we'll be having a series of town halls throughout the state over the next 6 months. So if you like us on our Facebook page, Michigan Transparency Coalition, you can find out about those town halls, attend them, and let us know what you'd like to see, what types of reforms you'd like us to push for in Michigan.
Jocelyn Benson, a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for spending time with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Jocelyn Benson is an election law professor at Wayne State University and is a former Democratic candidate for Secretary of State. An update now on a story that we covered for you here on Stateside, the controversial citizenship box on applications for this November's ballot. Now, these are the forms that you fill out before you get your actual ballot. That's when they ask for your name, address, and date of birth. Secretary of State Ruth Johnson had ordered clerks to put a question on that application asking voters to affirm their U.S. citizenship. But earlier this month, a federal judge ruled that citizenship question is unconstitutional. What happens now? Well, the Secretary of State's office has issued an official bulletin telling local clerks, do not use ballot applications that have the citizenship question on them. So local clerks have to decide whether to order all new ballot applications or simply cross out or obscure the question in some way. Now, this only settles the citizenship box question for this election. Secretary Johnson has not ruled out further legal action to try to get that question to be on future elections. So we'll see how this all unfolds. Still ahead, they'd hope to build a thriving film community in Michigan. But then the most generous tax incentives in the nation were cut way, way back. How are Michigan's actors, crew members, and all the movie support teams trying to keep the state's film and TV industry alive? That story is coming up here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The future of the proposed new international trade crossing bridge is being batted back and forth like a tennis ball. On one side of the net, billionaire ambassador bridge owner Matty Maroon pumping many millions of dollars in getting you to vote yes on Proposal 6. On the other side, Governor Rick Snyder joining today with Canadian Consul General Roy Norton, speaking out in favor of that second bridge that they want to build downriver. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick heard from the Maroon camp today and then attended that town hall meeting held by the governor. Sarah, let's start with the town hall meeting. I'm sure no one will be surprised at the message delivered by the governor and the Canadian Consul General.
No, there was really nothing surprising here. But I guess what was interesting about it was that obviously both these sides, both Governor Snyder and the Canadian Consul General Roy Norton, are really coming out with the unified message, which is two things that they've been pushing all along, that we really need to build this new bridge downriver. And everything you have heard about Proposal 6, that's the ballot proposal that would require a statewide referendum on any new international crossing, and I guess then in theory this bridge, everything you've heard about that on TV is pretty much a lie. And they are really working hard to push for the new bridge and to defeat Proposal 6.
Now, what do both sides say would happen if Michigan voters go to the polls in 15 days and they say yes to Proposal 6?
Well, in the past, both sides have said that it really shouldn't affect the proposed new international trade crossing. They think that there's language in there that would insulate that particular project. But it's very clear that they are not all that confident about that. And their big concern is that if Proposal 6 does pass, all sorts of legal issues will come up that will delay this project in the foreseeable future. And they were warning that, you know, all the stars are sort of aligning for the project right now in terms of leadership and funding, that that could go away at some point. And if this really doesn't get done as soon as possible, it's possible that it won't ever get done.
You got a chance today, Sarah, to hear from Canadian Consul General Roy Norton. So what did the Canadians bring as far as their arguments in favor of that second bridge?
Well, the Canadians, I think it's fair to say, desperately want this bridge. And Roy Norton, as they've been saying all along, that was assuring Michigan, speaking directly to Michigan voters and saying, Canada is going to pay for this entire project. You're not on the hook for it at all. Michigan has no liability in this regard. And he was saying basically that this is a win-win situation, but one that Canada is so invested in terms of it's their country's number one infrastructure priority right now, and basically that they're willing to do what it takes to get this done. In fact, Roy Norton said basically, we will not let Matty Maroon, the owner of the Ambassador Bridge, defeat the government of Canada.
So the line has been drawn in the sand, and at the very same time, Dan Stamper, who's the head of Matty Maroon's Ambassador Bridge Company, came out today and said, they've got to stop this boondoggle, and when they do, we are ready to invest in a state-of-the-art border crossing at no cost to taxpayers. So it's just quite an amazing standoff between one very rich family and these two government entities.
It is. It's really remarkable. And someone asked at that press conference earlier, a reporter asked, they said, you know, if Proposal 6 is defeated, when do you give up this fight? Because the owners of the Ambassador Bridge, the Detroit International Bridge Company, the Maroon family wants to build a second twin span. Canada doesn't want that. So, you know, basically, for all intents and purposes, it would be a bridge to nowhere. But they continue with this fight. And the reporter asked, when do you give up this fight? You know, they've spent, according to some reports, $20 million against just running ads against Proposal 6 alone. And Dan Stamper said, essentially, we don't plan on giving up this fight. And they have some pretty deep pockets, but it remains to be seen how much longer they can keep it up.
So we will stay tuned. Sarah Swick, thanks for your report.
Thank you.
That was Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Well, it was just a year or two ago when we had the likes of George Clooney, Ryan Gosling, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Gerard Butler, Hugh Jackman, James Franco, Mila Kunis, Michelle Williams, and so many more stars, all shooting films and TV shows all around Michigan. That was when Michigan offered subsidies for film and television production that were, at least for a while, the very best in the entire nation. But Governor Rick Snyder came into office arguing those generous production tax incentives were just not viable for our struggling state. The incentives program went from being uncapped to a $25 million cap for fiscal 2012. And with that, the tidal wave of film and TV production coming into Michigan slowed to a trickle. Peter Carey is a Michigan-based actor who'd managed to rack up parts in many productions in 2011, including the major DreamWorks film Real Steel, starring Hugh Jackman. Peter, in 2009, the subsidy program kicked in. What happened in terms of job opportunities and auditions for you when it was that uncapped huge subsidy?
Somebody opened the floodgates for work, and this town went crazy. Not just this town, but the state of Michigan, because we had, as you mentioned, the largest film incentive program in the country. Jump back a little bit to Governor Granholm talking about how can we get business to come in. And the interesting thing about the film industry is they're like an army. And I don't mean that in a negative way. What I mean it is they are able to come in en masse and really establish themselves and get things up and running instantly because they bring everything with them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want them to stay, you start to supply infrastructure and they'll stay. So Governor Granholm and her film committee said, how can we make this the best? 42% across the board. Wow. And did it work? Yes. The floodgates opened. And we could talk about details, but from my personal perspective, prior to the film incentives, I probably did two feature films here in Michigan.
Right.
Over, gosh.
Many, many, many years, right?
That would be over 8 years.
All right.
And then in the 2 years alone that the film incentives were rolling, I did 15. And here's an example. Masonic Temple, beautiful facility. Mm-hmm. Hollywood came in and they said, wow, this is incredible. We can use this. Detroit and Michigan is just a plethora of these wonderful locations, and Hollywood fell in love, and they came running. And that's why we had so many movies here, because we're kind of like an undiscovered gem, and they couldn't believe it.
And an eager workforce as well.
Yes, a very eager workforce, and a workforce who was used to labor, which is, it's hard work on a movie set. Mm-hmm. It really is. All we hear about are the stars who are in their trailers getting pampered. But the real guts of the thing are the hard workers, the grips, the gaffers, the crew that really get down there and do it. So going back to Masonic Temple, I bring that up because here's this beautiful facility, just this historic piece of wonderful backdrops, and Hollywood fell in love. I was there doing a movie, and you got on the elevator, and there were floors marked off, five different feature films shooting at one time.
Wow.
And they brought a lot of money. They brought a lot of support. And the thing about a film crew is they make it right. Meaning, if it doesn't look right, they'll say, well, let's fix this. They were going into locations that had poor electricity, other buildings, and saying, we want to use this for our location. Mm. They would put new infrastructure in. They'd put electricity. They'd put a roof on it. They'd fix it up at their expense. And then people they didn't understand. You know?
Then, because we get a new governor with some new priorities and new goals, and that tax credit goes to a $25 million cap. And for you?
Well, they took the wind out of the sails. They pulled the rug out. The door slammed. Literally, people were scared. And that's the thing about the film industry. Just like any other business, if they're going to invest, they need to have security. And we took that away. And they were getting mixed messages. You had a new governor that said, we're open for business. We want to be business friendly. But yet you had an industry here that was rolling along, and they said, yeah, we're open to business, but not really you.
Okay. And critics said that really the state was not getting the financial bang for those tax credit bucks. But how did it seem to you on the inside of that situation?
Well, people will say I'm biased because I had positive effects. Yes, it was good for us, but it was also good for communities. And like you said, the critics were poo-pooing it, and there was the Ernst & Young study that said we were getting $6 back in economic activity for every $1.
From the multiplier effect, from all the extra.
Yes. And we could argue this till we're blue in the face, but let's use an example of New York. New York now has set aside $220 million for 5 years. Well, that's over $1 billion to bring activity in. Has it worked? Oh, yeah.
Atlanta has stepped up, yeah.
Georgia, Louisiana has made their film tax credits permanent. Mm. And Georgia is trying to do that. Tyler Perry came in and built his whole studio complex there in Georgia, trying to say now, okay, let's make the tax incentives permanent. New York is at a 30% incentive. And now they've upped that to the post-incentive. Now, when you say post, well, it's post-production. Sure, you shoot the movie, but then there's all the post-production work that goes on. You can get 30% back in New York for that work, too. So, if you shoot your movie someplace else and you bring the post-work into New York, you still get 30% back.
Let me ask you, do you think that had the incentives program not been scaled back, would Michigan's film industry have become viable enough to get by with fewer incentives or to been able to ultimately phase the incentives out?
That was the plan from the beginning.
Yeah.
It was originally intended for 5 years. Give us 5 years. Let us build it. Let us get this baby rolling, and then we'll adjust. And I don't think you'll find anybody in our industry that didn't think it needed to be adjusted. Mm. Because 42%... got everybody's attention.
Sure.
I mean, they came banging on our door. They couldn't get here fast enough. Mm-hmm. But that's what Governor Granholm said. Let's make it the most eye-opening thing we can.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful.
Almost like a fire sale. Let's get them in.
Exactly.
Get them into the store.
Exactly. And they came running. Now, yes, it was originally intended for 5 years. Did it need to be adjusted over those years? Of course. But you don't. You don't pull the rug out from everybody and just say, sorry, We're open for business, but not that much.
Now, this coming fiscal year, there's $58 million available, so it's a fatter pot. What do you think will come from that?
Well, I'll be honest with you.
Are you getting any more interest?
It does. The $25 million was there last year, and that's a blip on the radar.
Okay. $8 million of that went unclaimed because I guess a production did not happen that was going to come.
Exactly.
Here. So now we have $58
million. Yeah, they'll roll that over.
Mm-hmm.
The $50 million, it sounds good, but it's a one-time appropriation. They don't think it'll be renewed.
Mm.
So they came up with a little extra money, and they said, okay, we'll throw another $25 million here. It's enticing, but is it a ball player? I mean, are you really in the game to play? No, not with New York, not with Louisiana, not with Georgia, not with South Carolina. Puerto Rico has incentives. Alaska has incentives. And they're serious about it because they see what happens. And California, Hollywood, the base of it all, they're struggling because they see runaway production. Because states, there are 40-plus states that offer incentives.
Now, I did hear an argument pretty persistently that, well, they're bringing their own people in. They're bringing people in from California, and they're going to just leave. So,
good point. Good point. At that point, we had people here willing to work, but we didn't know exactly how they wanted to work. So we were up and coming. We were in training. You saw people apprenticing that were Michigan residents. Now that the incentives are gone, the people that were trained here in Michigan are now at the helm of films in California, in Canada, in Louisiana. I know some excellent people here who were trained and got really good, and now she's living in Louisiana, and she sends notes to her family. Oh, I wish this still could be Michigan. I wish we could be together.
And you also see the economic hole sucked in the Pontiac area, where what used to be Raleigh Studios, where Oz the Great and Powerful was bustling a year ago, and it's a ghost town today, and it's not even Raleigh Studios anymore, is it?
That's true. That's true. Raleigh has pulled out. It's an unbelievable facility because they made it state-of-the-art. Raleigh does things right. They had great investors here in Michigan, and they wanted to make it top line. What happened was they took information that they'd learned from the auto industry. You know, the large stamping plants where they have all this vibration and noise? Well, there was a technique to silence the floors with compacted sand. They applied that to the movie studio. And so executives were coming going, I can't believe how quiet it is here. This is incredible. So there was a lot of cutting-edge technology, a lot of state-of-the-art science applied to that. And here is this facility that now is underutilized, to say the least.
Yeah, I happened to be out there for something, and it did have that tumbleweeds in the hallway look to it.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, where do you see Michigan's film industry, where it stands, where things stand right now? Where do you see it in 5 years?
That's an excellent question. I say that because we have an incredible creative community here. We have guts and glory, and they're really Detroiters, Michiganders, they're fighters. They love it. And they're very passionate, and they love their state. And I think we'll prevail as a state, but as far as the industry is concerned, you have to make a decision. Do you want to be a top player? Or do you just want to be somebody with tumbleweeds blowing through your studio? We could have more studios, but you got to bring it. You got to let them know that we are open for business and we're welcoming.
And you're not hearing that. What kind of response would you and other representatives of the industry get when you would try to talk to policymakers in Lansing?
I have been invited to speak only because I'm just another person who's impacted by it.
Mm-hmm.
I love the industry. I love a creative world, and it's one of the most creative outlets you can do. And we go to movies for recreation, for relaxation, for fun. It's a part of our lives. And everybody says, okay, well, film incentives are about the fat cats, the stars, and the big movie executives who don't need the money. It really isn't. It's not about fat cats. It actually costs a state money when people aren't working. And we have so many people here that were diving into the film industry because it was ready-made for them. And we slammed that door.
And you weren't able to sell that message in Lansing.
Well, we we came with passion, and then so we got the $25 million, and now this year they're throwing the bone of the mm-hmm. $50 million. But the scary thing is, like I said, is it's a one-time appropriation, and you have to go and ask for it every year again. You have to beg for the film incentives, whereas other states and countries have said, we are serious. This is permanent. We're here for you. You got to be real, you know?
Peter Carey, thank you for talking with us. Tomorrow on Stateside, we're going to continue our look at Michigan's film industry as we talk with Carrie Jones. She is the executive director of the Michigan Film Office. And that was Michigan-based actor Peter Carey. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Caddy. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow at 3. We'll